fact that we've been able to work cooperatively and solve that problem is a real plus for both projects.
The municipality of Anchorage reaches a deal with the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Young expresses frustration with the war in Afghanistan.
What makes you think we're going to go over there and sell our idea of democracy? And there is not a democracy. It's not going to work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan announced today that the city and Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, or KABATA, had reached agreement on the routing and right-of-way for the bridge terminus near the port of Anchorage.
As you know, I'm a big supporter of the bridge, and I want to make sure that it works. And at the same time, I'm a big supporter of my port, and I have to make sure that it works. So it was important for us to work together and come to a satisfactory conclusion.
The city had filed an appeal against the record of decision allowing the bridge project to go forward because of a dispute over how the Anchorage side of the bridge would impact parts of a port expansion project. Sullivan said the agreement ends the dispute.
There's a choke point behind the port where the access road to the bridge has to run, and there was concern that it might impact the operation of the port dry barge dock. And the fact that we've been able to work cooperatively and solve that problem is a real plus for both projects.
Sullivan said the lawsuit would be dropped by the middle of next week. The city is in the right-of-way acquisition process and plans to acquire some properties located at the city's Government Hill area behind the port. The Kinnick Arm Bridge project has already cost $60 million, according to city officials. The final cost estimate is closer to $750 million. Options for funding for the entire project are either to have the state pay for it or KABATA enter a public-private partnership in which the private partner would build the bridge. Population in the Matanuska-Susitna area is expected to double by the year 2035, according to studies made by ICER. The Kinnick Arm Bridge is expected to support the Glen Highway in providing access to Anchorage by an estimated 40,000 more drivers. Alaska's U.S. senators are part of a congressional effort to stop the Postal Service from closing branches in rural areas. APRN's Libby Casey reports on the Protecting Rural Post Offices bill.
When the U.S. Postal Service announced in July that it was considering closing down 3,700 branches, three dozen of them were in Alaska, most of them in rural communities. Alaska's delegation pushed back, and postal officials ended up taking all but five of them off the list. Even though most of Alaska's rural communities will keep their post offices for now, Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski say there should be rules governing which post offices the USPS can target for closure. They're part of a bipartisan group that introduced legislation Thursday to prevent the Postal Service from closing any locations that would leave the nearest branch more than 10 miles away, and that's on roads with year-round access. Senator Begich said in a written statement that there's no replacement for the post office in rural Alaska because it serves as a community center where locals get medicine, groceries, and vital equipment. Senator Murkowski pointed out that Alaska is, in her words, extremely limited in surface transportation during extreme winters, making 10 miles seem much farther in feet of snow and minimal visibility. There's still heated debate over one of the Alaskan branches on the possible closure list on Douglas Island, across the water from downtown Juneau. But otherwise, Alaska's rural communities were spared this time. The Alaska senators say this bill would prevent the post office from targeting them again. And even though Alaska fared well, they're standing in solidarity with rural colleagues. Other bill sponsors include senators from Montana and Kansas and Oregon, where 80% of the post offices on the potential closure list are more than 10 miles from the nearest branch, according to that state's delegation. The U.S. Postal Service is facing a grave financial crisis. It's afraid of defaulting on payments required to pre-fund its workers' future retirements and warned that it's looking at more than $8 billion in losses. Among the items that members of Congress are proposing to cut is funding for the bypass mail system, which subsidizes shipments to rural Alaska. Republican Representative Daryl Issa of California wants Alaska to reimburse the Postal Service for it, and the USPS says it costs at least $70 million a year. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Today marks the 10th anniversary of the start of the war in Afghanistan, a mission that has cost nearly 1,800 American lives. Alaska Congressman Don Young has always opposed the war. He says America cannot win.
Alexander the Great tried to whip that country, couldn't do it. The British tried to do it, couldn't do it. Russia tried to do it for 10 years, couldn't do it. What makes you think we're going to go over there and sell our idea of democracy to an area that's not a democracy? It's not going to work.
Representative Young, who also opposes American intervention in Libya, says he supports U.S. soldiers and wants them to have the best equipment and training, but believes the military should refocus its efforts.
Just pull us out and establish our armed services here, train our armed services here, have them available for home defense.
Young says traditional warfare is becoming a thing of the past as the military moves toward an increasingly high-tech approach in which drones and robots replace troops in battle. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a major dam project for the Mat-Su Valley.
On an annual basis, we look at its annual output to be roughly 2,600 gigawatt hours, meeting about 50% of the rail belt's needs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
A search and rescue team from Angoon rescued a Sitka crab fisherman whose boat rolled over and sank in Chatham Strait yesterday. 59-year-old Peter Roddy was aboard his 42-foot crabber, the Jaeger, when the bow dipped, followed by the stern. First Sergeant Charlie Hartzell is the village public safety officer in Angoon. He says Roddy had to act quickly.
Mr. Roddy stated that he had approximately 10 seconds to release and get into his life raft. After Mr. Roddy said after that he got into his life raft, the vessel actually rolled to its side and eventually sunk.
From his life raft, Roddy released smoke, which was spotted by a passing aircraft. The call for help came into Angoon around 11:50 yesterday morning.
Angoon Search and Rescue was in the vicinity with our rescue craft. Mr. Roddy was transferred to Angoon Search and Rescue en route to Angoon, at which time he was taken to the Angoon Search Clinic and released with a clean bill of health.
Hartzell says visibility at the time of the rescue was 100%, with seas around 2 feet. The National Weather Service office in Juneau reports winds at 10 to 15 knots in the area at the time of the incident. An oil sheen approximately 1,500 yards by 100 yards was visible immediately after the sinking. A helicopter from the Coast Guard station, air station in Sitka was performing an overflight today to update that measurement. The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood are celebrating a big anniversary. Officers and delegates at the 99th Annual Grand Camp Convention are meeting this week in Klawak on Prince of Wales Island. The meeting has the theme, Reviewing 100 Years of History, Preparing for the Next. The Brotherhood was organized in 1912 and calls itself the United States' oldest Indigenous persons civil rights organization. The Sisterhood formed several years later. The meeting at Klawak High School continues through tomorrow. Beyond history, members are discussing the landless natives issue, tobacco cessation programs, and suicide prevention. The ANB and ANS will also elect officers and pass resolutions, guiding the organization's direction for the next year. A state-sponsored economic development panel wants suggestions for creating new timber industry jobs. The Alaska Timber Jobs Task Force will hear comments from the public during a meeting today and Saturday in Kaufman Cove. The town is a former logging camp on Prince of Wales Island. Governor Sean Parnell created the task force last spring with a focus on Southeast. State Forester Chris Mache, a member, says it has a number of goals.
One of those does speak to state forests, recommendations for additional acreage or even recommendations for additional units in the state forest. And of course, that can be statewide potentially.
Public comments started being gathered today at Kaufman Cove City Hall. Teleconference connections will also be available at Department of Natural Resources conference rooms in Juneau, Fairbanks, and at the Division of Forestry offices in Anchorage and Ketchikan. Saturday's session will take comments by phone. In addition to state forest management, the task force is focusing on state harvest rules, timber demand, and Tongass timber sales. Parnell created the task force after pulling out of the Tongass Futures round table, which had a broader agenda and membership, including logging opponents. This week's election results saw changes in local representation in communities across Alaska. Voters gave the nod or the nay to ballot proposals dealing with schools, roads, and utilities. But in the tiny Susitna Valley town of Talkeetna, voters made a choice that could have repercussions far from the community. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
After the ballots were counted, Talkeetna voters opposed the construction of the Susitna-Watonna Dam, 109 to 19. The referendum on the town's community council election ballot was meant to gauge the residents' attitude toward the dam. The community council wants to know where to stand on the issue. The mega project is often overshadowed by the debate over the pebble mine in southwest Alaska. Although the Susitna-Watonna Dam could become the eighth highest dam in the world. And Richard Leo, a Trapper Creek resident and longtime journalist, is worried that there's not enough information out there about it.
It's really just a dumb idea.
The dam project is part of the state administration's goal of reaching 50% of its electric generation through renewable resources by 2025.
This goal can be met by building the Susitna-Watonna project.
That's Karsten Rodvik, a spokesman for the Alaska Energy Authority. In January of this year, Governor Parnell introduced legislation authorizing the Alaska Energy Authority to pursue the huge hydroelectric project. The state legislature approved, and Parnell signed the legislation in early July, appropriating $65 million for the dam. Leo's worried that AEA is rushing into the project.
This has all happened so fast. The dam is running under the radar because the information on the dam is misleading. AEA says, for instance, that the dam will get 600 megawatts of electricity. In fact, AEA admits that it will only get 280 to 300 megawatts of electricity on average per year.
Rodvik says it all depends on water flow.
Yes, there's going to be variations in water flow seasonally, you know, but on an annual basis, we look at its annual output to be roughly 2,600 gigawatt hours, meeting about 50% of the rail belt's needs.
The Susitna-Watonna Dam is to be 700 feet high, harnessing waters of the upper Susitna River for energy needs and supplying half the rail belt's energy for the next 100 years. But Rodvik denies the project is on the fast track and under the radar. He says applying to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the first step.
We expect to complete the preliminary application document this winter and file it with FERC. That is a necessary step in the process. And then we're looking at about up to roughly 6.5 years of field studies, public involvement, environmental impact statement preparation, and the FERC licensing process. So that's a long and extensive, complex process that involves substantial public involvement as well.
Leo says the need for electricity can be met using alternative renewable energy methods like wind or tidal. If constructed, the Susitna-Watonna Dam could start providing electricity for the rail belt by 2023. Construction is expected to take 5 years. The cost, $4.5 billion. But Rodvik says that might be reduced.
We're involved in ongoing engineering, and the final construction method has not yet been determined. That will be laid out in the preliminary application document to FERC. Two methods under consideration are an embankment dam using natural materials or a construction technique called roller compacted concrete. If indeed it were to be a roller compacted concrete style dam, cost would likely be less than what has been originally estimated.
The dam would create a lake 39 miles long, 2 miles wide, on the Susitna River, causing obvious impacts to Game Unit 13, an area rich in caribou and moose that is popular with sport and subsistence hunters. Rodvik says the area has been studied for hydropower potential since the 1980s. Gap studies detailing changes to the region are underway, and AEA is working with appropriate agencies on required environmental studies. But Leo says there's basic dangers to people posed by the dam.
The dam is on or within 40 miles of the Denali Fault, which has registered a 7.9 earthquake relatively recently. So if the dam were to fail, you can kiss Trapper Creek and Talkeetna goodbye.
Rodvik says the dam would be designed to withstand seismic events. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state has paid more than $91,000 in expenses for lawmakers who attended a recent policy tour in Norway. Records provided by the Legislative Affairs Agency may not be complete. Lawmakers have 60 days from the time of their return to submit expenses or receipts for reimbursement. The trip ended September 4th. 12 lawmakers were among the Alaskans attending.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Support for AK comes from the Federal Aviation Administration, providing information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jocelyn Estes. This week on AK, The Famous Bus. The book and movie adaptation of Into the Wild prompts some Alaskans to roll their eyes, but the account of Christopher McCandless's ill-fated pilgrimage to the Bus 142 inspires many others to follow his path on the Stampede Trail. But the trek to the bus can be dangerous, even fatal. Reporter Diana Saverin decided to take her own trip there and has this story.
When my friend Jonathan Christ Tompkins and I headed out in mid-August to find the bus, we wanted to find out why people trek to the bus. It wasn't long before we learned just how wrong those pilgrimages can go. Just a few hours in, we met Etienne, a French backpacker. He had been on the trail the year before with a friend, and what started as a fun hike and turned out to be a very unfortunate trip.
Everything was perfect. Like, the weather was beautiful. We had the Mont McKinley, and it was a great hike. But then, yeah, that's some accident, and she was really experienced as well. She was scuba diver, she did lot of mountaineering and lot of things. But the water was so cold, and the way we did it was maybe not the best as well, so.
His friend died when they tried to cross the Teklinika River, the same river that trapped McCandless 20 years ago. Etienne was building a memorial to mark the anniversary of her death and encouraged travelers to think twice about their river crossings. The Teklinika is the largest river en route to Bus 142, and certainly the most dangerous. When we reached it, the Teklinika was running fast and high, so we used a pack raft to cross, trying to avoid too many thoughts about Etienne's experience the year before. 1 hour, two sets of wet clothes, and three braids of Raging River later, we celebrated our safety and looked for a campsite. To our surprise, we found three tents. A peculiar group of three beleaguered backpackers emerged, two young Catalans and Phil, a 50-year-old from Tennessee. This is Phil on how they ended up in Alaska and on the wrong side of the Tuklanika River. So what brings you to Alaska?
They didn't want to see the magic bus and I promised them. So I said, buddy, I'm old. So I said, okay. I said, let's go.
Dan, one of the Catalans, described what drew him to Alaska and ultimately his two companions.
I felt very identified with the guy of the movie Into the Wild. And when I found out that the bus, it was really here, still here in Alaska, I decided to try to come here and see what it was all about.
Dan persuaded his reluctant friends to make the trip up with him. They had sunshine on the way in, and the river was running low. Dan assumed that luck would hold.
I thought it was going to be pretty low with the level of the water. I didn't know exactly what to expect, but I was thinking about it's going to be not going to be too hard to do it.
Once they made it to the bus, it started raining. The river rose. Soon, the three were trapped, just as McCandless was, on the far side of the Tuklanika.
It started raining again and again, and we didn't know if we were going to cross soon or not. And tomorrow, I was going to go to the bus again to get some food that people has been living there in the bus, because we were running out of food almost, and we didn't know how many days we're going to to spend here.
That's when Jonathan and I showed up. We wanted to help the travelers with our raft, but first we were curious about the infamous bus. So we walked 10 more miles down the well-worn trail. We were startled to come across the bus. It seemed out of place, like discovering a TV set on the summit of a remote wilderness peak. Oh, look. Come here. Jack London. The bus has become a shrine of sorts. A logbook is full of tributes to McCandless and essays contemplating the ideals of adventure. It's been stripped for souvenirs and stocked with tchotchkes, as well as binoculars, backpacks, food, sleeping bags, books, and a bottle of Jack Daniel's whiskey. Curiosity satisfied, we returned to the Tuklanika and the stranded party of three. We began ferrying them across with our pack raft, but soon realized it was not safe. Our pack raft could hold 250 pounds. Phil weighed 350. So after a failed ferrying attempt, he remained on the far side of the Tuklanika with one of his Catalan companions. The three of us walked out to Healy, where Dan notified the state troopers of the predicament. The next day, Phil and his friend were helicoptered out of the wilderness. The rescue resulted in a short article in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, just another version of a story that has been all too common these last few years. All inspired by one person and one bus. For AK, and with help from Jonathan Christ Tompkins, I'm Diana Savran.
And now it's time for a road trip up the Dalton Highway for our 300 Villages segment. 260 miles north of Fairbanks is a small settlement, really just a big truck stop, called Coldfoot Camp. This time of year, a small crew of workers live there to provide services to the truckers on their way to Prudhoe Bay.
My name is Jeremy Blackman. I do serving and cleaning and maintenance and tire repair in Coldfoot. Coldfoot is the world's northernmost truck stop. We're here in the Arctic, about 60 miles north of the Arctic Circle. We're extremely vital for all the trucking that goes through the area up to Prudhoe Bay. Mainly we serve the truckers food. We have lodging available, and we also do a lot of repair on tires and trucks, since Alaska's Dalton Highway is not very kind to their tires and their trucks. And there's about 15 of us that work up here in the wintertime, and we're just having a blast out here in the middle of nowhere. Our summer staff swells to about 35 people at its peak because we get a lot of tourism and we service a lot of hunters during hunting season. But yeah, you know, once it starts getting cold, the only people that really come up are the truckers. You know, we have to be really creative to keep ourselves entertained and stuff. You know, we have a bunch of sled dogs up here, so there's a lot of dog mushing that we do. I mean, sitting out watching the aurora forever. We're right under the auroral oval, like right directly under it, so we get some of the best aurora in the whole world here when the sky's clear. Our burgers are amazing. They're half-pound burgers. We ground all the beef here. We bake the buns ourselves. Almost everything we serve here is homemade, which is really cool. It's all made, a lot of it's made from scratch. We do have internet, but it's pretty stone age. We have no cell phone reception up here, which is actually pretty nice. We like to get away from, you know, that. And a lot of people that visit are surprised. They're like, oh, do you get any cell phone reception? We're just like, no, there's no cell phone reception here. Colfoot's a really awesome place, and I guess a lot of people just don't know about it. I was really surprised, actually, when I went back to Fairbanks, how few people know about Colfoot. You know, I mean, we've been on that show, Eyes for Truckers. We get a lot of fans that come in, and they're like, oh, can we meet the truckers, blah, blah, blah. And we're just like, what? Like, you know, because no one here really watches that show. So it's just, it's kind of a really remote place that apparently has some fame for some people. And that's just always kind of funny now and then. It's really kind of bizarre, actually, when you drive out of the camp, there's a sign that says next service is 240 miles, and it says, like, Prudhoe Bay, Dead Horse, and the other direction says next service is, like, 250 miles, like, Fairbanks, and it points the other way, and so it's like, oh, okay. So, yeah, we're isolated, but we all like it here. It's a really cool place.
Jeremy Blackman lives and works at Coldfoot Camp on the Dalton Highway. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Diana Saverin and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for a story on one of the biggest football rivalries in the state. I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Jocelyn Estes was our guest host for AK this week. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Reconnect with family and friends in Anchorage this fall. Explore the diverse shops, restaurants, and attractions. Catch Fiddler on the Roof and other Broadway shows. And find cool events like Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, or simply enjoy PFD shopping. For big deals and more wild ways to play, visit anchorage.net/fall. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.